This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Hot Topics, episode number 10, was recorded on March 18th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This special episode is sponsored by, drumroll please, my own vacation property on the coast of Maine. Tourist season looks like a write-off at this point due to the COVID-19 crisis, so I'm looking to repurpose my vacation rental as a COVID-19 retreat. It would be ideal for someone who needs to escape from New York, so to speak, and needs a big home in the countryside to ride out the COVID-19 crisis outside the city for the sake of social distancing. I'll tell you all about it at the end of today's podcast. I want to thank the many people who have donated. We actually received our first $5,000 donation this week, and that was extremely flattering, and it makes possible more content. In fact, it made me feel obliged to produce today's episode because there's a bunch of stuff going on, and quite a few of you have been writing in and asking for more content. So I'm going to give you another no guest this time. It's just me, and I'm going to give you the update on COVID-19 that will go on quite a bit longer than we have time for in the regular market wrap on Macro Voices. So there's three main topics that I want to talk about on this episode. Number one, the Imperial College report from the UK has gotten just a fantastic amount of attention in the last 24 hours. It's kind of strange to me because I think, frankly, Professor Neil Ferguson, the principal author, has said most of the things that it contains in his other interviews previous to this. But for some reason, this report is really getting a lot of attention. So I'm going to talk about that report in some detail. Number two, I want to give you an update on my own outlook for how this crisis is going to go. It seems like everybody just in the last couple of days is just beginning to wake up to, holy cow, you know, this is actually real. That Townsend guy is not just a crazy crackpot conspiracy theorist after all. Folks, I think from everything I'm seeing that people are really at a tip of iceberg stage. I don't think they've even begun to come to terms with what's about to happen. I think it's going to be a bigger deal than most people expect, and I'll explain why. And final topic, making it personal. I'm pretty sure that I have what so far is only a mild COVID-19 infection. I've been sick for coming up on 3 weeks now. And at first, I really wanted to believe it was just a common cold or something. But for a number of reasons, I'll describe that experience. And the reason I want to cover it in today's podcast is I think a lot of people are going to go through what I've been going through for the last couple of weeks, which is this very emotionally challenging experience of, boy, I'm only a little bit sick. I don't think I'm a critical COVID patient, but do I have it or don't I have it? Well, the one thing I do know is that it would be completely pointless to engage my healthcare system. There are no tests available in my area. I wouldn't be able to get one. And frankly, I know more about this than the average doc-in-a-box MD down the street here. So I'm on my own, and it's a very interesting experience. So I'll talk about that some later on. Let's start with the Imperial College report. You'll find a link in the description of this podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com next to my picture. I really encourage you to download this, particularly because it contains some graphs and charts that I'm going to talk about during today's podcast. So if you're able to download that and have it at hand as we get into this discussion, that's going to help. Now, ironically, the whole world seems to be freaking out this morning on Wednesday, the 18th of March, 2020, over this report that's just come out in the last couple of days. And there's been some sensationalist reporting saying, you know, this is the secret report that panicked the White House and caused President Trump to change his tone and suddenly get serious about this crisis. I don't think there's anything secret about this. It's a publicly published report, so I think that's just sensationalism. But it is true that the whole world seems to be freaking out over this report. Now, frankly, Neil Ferguson, and just for our finance listeners, we're not talking about Professor Neil Ferguson from Harvard, the economist that you probably know. It's the other Professor Neil Ferguson, the one who spells his name Neil the usual way, not the way the economics guy does. This Professor Neil Ferguson, who I assume is with Imperial College, has been one of the smartest guys I've watched as all of the interviews that I could find with this guy on YouTube and so forth. Very smart guy. Frankly, I think just about everything in this report he's been saying for the last few weeks. Now it's packaged in the format of an academic report. So maybe that's just making it more digestible, but I think mostly it's the graphs and charts that are making it more digestible for more people. The thing about this is, frankly, everybody's getting totally freaked out, like, oh my gosh, this is much more serious than we thought. And they're getting freaked out over this Imperial College report, which, as far as I'm concerned, is really using the most conservative numbers possible. We've seen from the Los Alamos report that I've talked about in previous podcasts or the China Academy of Sciences, there are R-naught estimates. That's the transmissivity or contagiousness index for a virus, ranging as high as 6.6, according to the Los Alamos National Laboratory study. Now, in this report, Professor Ferguson is using a range of 2.2 to 2.4, which is the very bottom end of the credible estimate. So if I read between the lines here, I think what Ferguson is doing is trying to create something which cannot be contentious. I think he's trying to go with the most conservative numbers, the ones that everybody agrees it's at least that bad. Likewise, he's leaving out some very important arguments that would really describe why the situation might be worse than this report leads one to believe. It's not because he's an ignorant guy. He's a very, very smart guy. If I read between the lines, it's pretty clear to me what's going on is anything that could be a subject of contention or debate, I think he's intentionally leaving it out because he wants to give the world something clear that nobody is going to question. And I'll talk about what some of those things are that got left out in just a few minutes. I think probably the key to why it's gotten so much attention is just that it contains some very intuitively clear graphs. And it reminds me, actually, you know, when Remy Tito at Real Vision put out a graph showing the exponential growth curve that was occurring in South Korea, I think he had Italy and then he had United States imposed on top of Italy or whatever. I don't remember exactly what it was, but all that Remy had done, it seemed to me, when I saw this graph that got a lot of attention, was he took the exact same thing that Jim Bianco's been talking about for a month, which is this is exponential growth, and you have to expect that what that means is you're going to get not just a plus X number of cases, but it's going to keep doubling or keep multiplying by some factor every fixed period of time. What Remy Tito did was just to make that intuitively clear by superimposing one country on top of the other. That got a huge amount of attention. And what I realized is Remy's real talent there, and Remy, if you're listening, my hat is off to you, sir, because you woke up a lot of people that were not getting it with that excellent, excellent work that you did. Now, all that he did was just to take the same stuff that Jim Bianco's been talking about for a month and make it intuitively clear. The way he superimposed one graph on top of another, you can just look at it and say, oh my gosh, that one's going in the same direction as the other one. I can see where this story is headed now, and it's visually and intuitively clear. Now, hopefully, Macro Voices listeners are already familiar with this concept of flattening the curve that we've talked about before. If you look at page 8 in the Imperial College report, that red horizontal line across the very, very bottom, that's actually the hospital system capacity. As soon as you go above that red line that's way, way, way down at the very bottom, that's where you get to the point where hospitals are overwhelmed and cannot handle the number of patients that they have. And you see these various colored lines here. They're showing you the projection depending on a range from everything which starts with doing nothing all the way to taking all of the available measures toward case isolation, aggressive contact tracing, home quarantine, social distancing, and so on and so forth. The point is, on one hand, it makes a huge difference if you take these NPIs, they're called non-pharmaceutical interventions, to try to slow down the spread of the disease. But no matter what you do, you still end up overloading healthcare capacity by a factor of, you know, at least 10, probably more than 10. So the point is, no matter what we do, we're going by the end of May to have a really, really serious problem where our healthcare facilities are completely overwhelmed. This chart on page 8 is not new information. Dr. Chris Martinson fully explained this concept in his January 30th interview on Macro Voices, but it didn't come with a picture that made it intuitively clear. And this picture with a red line shows you what the capacity of the healthcare system is, and the other colored lines show you what's going to be expected in terms of demand on that system. You just look at this graph and you're like, holy crap, we've got a problem, Houston. So on one hand, there's no new information here. Martinson explained this all to you on January 30th. But boy, this graph really sends the message home. So I think that's probably why this particular report is suddenly getting so much attention all of a sudden. But here's a really, really important point. This report is making the case that Chris Martinson made on January 30th, which is that the serious complication rate for this disease is much more important than the fatality rate. And the situation that we have to be concerned with is not everybody dying, but rather the entire Western world's healthcare systems being completely overwhelmed to the point where hospitals can't possibly meet the demand for all of the patients that need hospital care. Martinson said that on the 30th of January. It's still true today. This chart on page 8 really drives home why it's clear. But the next thing Chris Martinson told us never gets into this report. And I think the reason is that Ferguson was probably trying to only say the things, you know, essentially feeding people only as much as they could swallow, not giving them any contentious arguments or things that might be subject to debate. The next argument that Chris Martinson made is he said, wait a minute, the case fatality rate is known to be fairly low for COVID-19 when you have medical care available. In other words, about 20% of the people who contract COVID-19 end up needing to be hospitalized, usually with curable viral pneumonia. Okay. If those people get hospitalized and receive their hospital care and so forth, the case fatality rate is only about, well, we used to think it was 2%. Now the World Health Organization is telling us 3.4% is a better estimate. So, okay, that is a pretty scary number, frankly, when you get down to it. But, you know, it's not nearly as bad as SARS or MERS or some of these other diseases. What Chris Martinson explained on January 30th is, and think about George Soros' concept of reflexivity, for those of you who are familiar with it, there is a feedback loop where the case fatality rate, when you have a functioning medical system, is at one level, because 20% of the cases have to go and be hospitalized and receive treatment with ventilators and intubation for viral pneumonia. If the hospitals are full and you've got viral pneumonia and you need to be intubated and you need to breathe on a ventilator for a few weeks in order to save your life, and there aren't any ventilators because all the hospitals are completely overloaded, all of a sudden, the case fatality rate goes up dramatically because the only option to people who have what might have been a curable viral pneumonia is to do their best trying to treat it at home. And as we remember those horrific stories from Hubei province in China, where people were obviously sick and dying from this disease, were being turned away from hospitals because the hospitals just couldn't take any more patients. That kind of scenario is what you have to worry about with this disease. And the picture on page 8 shows you why it would be a problem. But making that connection to this having a feedback into dramatically increasing the case fatality rate never gets mentioned in this paper. It's not because Ferguson is not smart enough to understand this. He gets it. This guy is super smart. My conjecture is that he probably didn't want to put anything in this report that was the slightest bit subjective or subject to debate. I think he was trying to present something that nobody would question. So that's the reason that he left that argument out, but it's very, very important to understand. So there's really nothing in this report that was not covered on the January 30th episode of Macro Voices, other than that they've quantified and modeled the concepts that Chris Martinson talked about, and they've got nice graphs and charts. Those graphs and charts, though, if you look now at page 9, and on the left-hand side, you see the R-naught values, the R with the little subscript 0. Those R-naught values that you see of 2.2 or 2.4, those are at the very low end of the range of estimates that have been published by various different reports on COVID-19. Once again, my conjecture here is that what Ferguson is trying to do is avoid any argument by just going at the low end of the range where nobody's going to question whether he's overstating how bad it is. I think it is worthwhile to at least consider how bad it might be, to consider all possibilities. Remember, the Los Alamos National Laboratories report concluded that the actual value of R-naught for COVID-19 was somewhere between 4.7 and 6.6. And furthermore, they concluded that even when you impose a total lockdown on society, and of course the purpose of the lockdown is to reduce the value of R-naught. R-naught is how many people one infected person is going to give it to. Even in those circumstances, when you impose a society-wide lockdown, R-naught drops from 4.7 to 6.6 down to about 2.4 or 2.5. So even after you did a lockdown, which is not being proposed by this report, in the worst case assumed by the Los Alamos report, you would end up with an R-naught of 2.4 after the lockdown, and that's what he's assuming going in here is as bad as it is. So I think that Ferguson has approached this from the standpoint of being as conservative as he can, not overstating anything, and erring toward the best imaginable case. The best imaginable case, as you can see from these graphs, is pretty darn scary. We need to think about what the worst case would look like, and it is not a pretty picture by any stretch of the imagination. So, to summarize my reactions to this report, it's all stuff that's been said before. Almost everything here Chris Martinson told you on January 30th, and certainly Neil Ferguson has said almost everything in this report in his various interviews before this date. But it seems like the publication of this report was almost like a Lehman moment, if you will. Long before Lehman failed, the smartest people in finance knew what was coming. If you watch The Big Short, you know the smartest guys in the room had it all figured out months and months ahead of time. But Lehman was the moment where it really just hit home for the average Joe Schmuck in finance. Wow, one of the biggest investment banks in the world just went under. This really is a big deal. I think this report is having kind of a Lehman moment kind of effect. When people saw this graph on page 8, they started to freak out. And whether it's true that this is what caused the White House to change its tune or not, certainly the internet is reporting it as if this is the secret report that changed Trump's mind about COVID-19. I doubt he's actually looked at it. But if people think that, it still has that Lehman moment kind of effect psychologically. I personally am convinced that this report is depicting the best possible outcome scenario. He's using the lowest possible values for R-naught. He's not talking about that reflexive feedback loop that increases case fatality rate as the medical system gets overwhelmed. There's a lot of things that are not covered here. So I think, you know, what's the old saying? Remember the Alamo? I'd say remember Los Alamos National Laboratories in that report. What if R-naught is actually 6.6, the high end of the range that they predicted? That would dramatically, dramatically change the graph on page 8 and make those lines go much higher. Well, look at them already. They're already orders and orders of magnitude above the capacity of the healthcare system. So we've got a really serious problem no matter what, and it might be even more serious than this report seems to suggest. Again, I think that what Ferguson's doing here, if I'm reading correctly between the lines, is he's trying to present the most conservative information, essentially feeding people what they can swallow so that nobody is going to disagree with it or claim that he's exaggerating anything. And I think that's the reason he's using the conservative numbers that he is going in. I definitely encourage you to read it. Again, the download link is in the description of today's podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Let's move on to our second topic, which is an update on my overall outlook for this crisis, and specifically why I think we need to start thinking about whether a Hubei China-like scenario could occur in the United States. Now, finally, 6 weeks after the data became clear, and it's 6 weeks after Macro Voices listeners learned about this, we see people finally starting to freak out now. I think the main reason that that's happening is because we just went from 10,000 to 100,000 infections or reported cases outside of China in the last 2 weeks. Well, again, exponential growth seems to always take everybody by surprise, even though it shouldn't. It doesn't mean we're going to get another 100,000 in the next 2 weeks. What it means is, because of exponential growth, we're going to go from 100,000 cases to 1 million cases in the next 2 weeks. The world is freaking out over what's already happened. They have no idea what's about to happen. And that means you go from 1 million cases to 10 million cases in 1 month's time, or roughly speaking, by the middle of April. Now, to be clear, I absolutely do not expect that officially reported numbers will count cases anywhere close to that high by mid-April or any other time. But that's not because the infections aren't there. That number of infections will be there. That kind of exponential growth is going to occur. The thing is, we don't have the capacity to test for it. So we're not going to be able to report that number of infections, because we can't have 10 million reported infections without 10 million test kits. And we haven't seemed to gotten our act together around that yet. The way that you'll measure it, though, is by the medical system becoming completely overwhelmed. And if you go back to Ferguson's chart on page 8, you see by mid-April is where he's showing, depending on whether you do nothing or you take all of the possible interventions that you possibly can think of, that's going to change how long it takes. It could be the second week of April, or it could be the third week of April, that the entire healthcare system gets overwhelmed. But it's going to happen one way or another. By the 1st of May, I think it's going to be really clear as the healthcare system, this particular report is for the UK. I think that the United States might be as much as a week, probably half a week behind Europe, so it may take a little longer, but certainly by the 1st of May, we're going to have a really, really serious problem, and it will be, in terms of public perception, a full order of magnitude worse than the way people perceive things right now. At this point, we've got some people very concerned about this, but frankly, spring break is going strong in Florida and Texas. Kids are partying on beaches. Most of the restaurants around the country, when they heard that they were going to have a ban where they would be shut down, they announced a last call party where they had a great big get together with wall-to-wall people, partying, because they knew it would be their last chance to party in a bar before they got shut down. People are behaving in ways that are incredibly irresponsible right now because they don't get it. And frankly, the reason they don't get it is because their own government has been lying to them and telling them that there was nothing to worry about and there was a very low risk and so forth. By the 1st of May, everybody's going to get it, and I think it'll be sooner than that. But certainly by the 1st of May, it will be very clear that hospital systems are completely overwhelmed around the United States and the rest of the world. So after considering all of these things, I personally believe that where we really are right now is just at the tip of the iceberg stage. For a while, it was just a few people like myself who sounded like crazy lunatics trying to get people to pay attention to this. Finally, the mainstream is waking up to the fact that there's a serious problem. But they don't have any idea what's coming, the scope of this, and how significant of a crisis it's going to be for the entire world. People still have no idea, or at least that's my opinion as of this moment. We got freaked out over 100,000 cases. We're going to, in 2 weeks, have 1 million cases. We won't have that many reported because we don't have enough tests, but they'll be there. And in a month, we'll have 10 million cases, and it will overwhelm our medical facilities. So I want you to ask yourself a question now. What if what happened in Hubei province in China. Remember all of those horrible videos? It seemed like martial law, crazy, crazy things happening with people being dragged from their homes, just radical, draconian lockdown measures. More Chinese citizens than the entire population of the United States at one point were on lockdown, not allowed to leave their homes. I want you to imagine, what if that happened in the United States? Now, I know most of you immediately said, no freaking way. That's completely impossible. Eric, you're fear-mongering. You're being a conspiracy theorist. Stop scaring people. Look, I'm not afraid myself. I don't want you to be afraid, but I do want you to look at the facts and look realistically at what could happen here. And fear and panic don't help anybody, so let's not do that. But let's look at the facts and objectively consider, if you think that's not possible, why not? Why do you think it's not possible? Here are the facts. It is definitely true that aggressive testing, contact tracing, and strict quarantines and case isolation have worked and worked well for Singapore, Hong Kong, and Taiwan, and also South Korea. South Korea has really done, you know, they got hit kind of blindsided with this one super spreader event that caused just massive, massive cluster of cases. It went out of control briefly, but they managed to get it back under control. And they did that through aggressive testing. Fantastic innovation. South Korea invented the idea of drive-through testing so that you wouldn't have to go into a waiting room where you could be infected by other people waiting to be tested. They innovated this idea of delivering your test results to your phone automatically, and furthermore, a GPS-aware app for your phone so that it knows where you are, it knows where the people who are infected are, and it warns you if you're in close proximity to people who are infected. Doing all of those kinds of things, being way ahead of the curve on technology innovation and generally just really being on top of this thing, they got it under control. Now, they didn't get it under control until they had hundreds of deaths and almost 10,000 cases in South Korea, but it seems like from their case growth, they've pretty much got it under control. What China did wrong at first is they didn't take this seriously. When Dr. Li Wenliang, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that, the late Dr. Li Wenliang figured this out and sounded the alarm bells and said, hey, we got an epidemic on our hands. He was arrested and detained and punished by the Chinese government for spreading rumors. And they tried to sweep it under the carpet and pretend it wasn't a problem. Frankly, as far as I'm concerned, the United States is repeating China's mistakes rather than learning from them. For most of the last month, the U.S. government has been reassuring everybody. There's absolutely nothing to worry about. The risk is low. There's no reason to be concerned. Don't wear a face mask. Don't buy any extra groceries. Don't prepare for this. You don't need to worry about it. The risk is low. Now, all of a sudden, we're finally waking up. But if you listen to what Trump said in this most recent press conference, somebody asked him about would there be a national lockdown? And he shook his head and he said, no, look. And he started to answer the question. He said, look, in order to actually impose a national lockdown, it would have to get to the point that, and he caught himself and he decided not to give them specific criteria, probably because he didn't want people to anticipate the government's moves, which was reasonably smart on his part. But consider what the essence of what he was saying is. It really translates to, we're going to wait until it's too late for it to do any good before we consider that. They should have been thinking about national lockdown weeks ago, and they're not going to do that until it's too late. Spring break is raging out of control. A lot of colleges and universities, for their students' health, told them to stay home. They all went and bought, not all of them, but quite a few of them, bought airline tickets and took trips around the world because the fares are cheap. Our behavior is making this worse, and the government is not showing the leadership that is needed in order to bring that under control. The conclusions of the Los Alamos National Laboratories report, the China Academy of Sciences report, and now this new report from Imperial College are all the same. They all conclude that the only thing that works to contain a virus that is this contagious is aggressive social distancing to the point of lockdown type of measures. We're paying a little bit of lip service to that, but we're not really doing it. President Trump said in his press conference that he's disappointed in those thousands and thousands of college students that are spreading this virus by ignoring the direction. You know, being disappointed is one thing. Being commander-in-chief is another. We've already squandered more than a month of precious time that could have been used really getting on top of this. Policy has been very clear. We're going to wait until it's too late. And as one of the doctors from the World Health Organization said, you've got to be willing to take a chance and take action before you can prove that it's necessary. What the government's doing is waiting until they can prove it was necessary before they take any action. That's the fatal mistake. Even worse, they're circulating false information. Now, I'm going to tell you the truth about face masks. Face masks are one of the most important measures. They're essential in combating a viral outbreak like this. They were used in China, in South Korea, in Singapore, in all the places that have been successful. Now, it's misunderstood. The value of the face mask in preventing the person who's wearing the face mask from getting infected is minimal. It's there, but it's not great. What the face masks are super, super effective at is preventing someone who's contagious from spreading the disease. In other words, they sneeze, they're sneezing into the face mask. They cough into the face mask. The droplets don't get into the air, they don't get aerosolized, and they don't get onto other people. In order for that to work, it doesn't mean you can wear a face mask if you're trying to protect yourself. It means everybody in society has to wear one. And that's the reason that China actually used drone enforcement. You were subject to arrest in China if you were out of doors without a face mask on, and they had drones flying around looking for anybody not wearing a face mask, and they would track you down, and a loudspeaker on the drone would tell you, you will be arrested. You know, police are on their way to arrest you if you don't put a face mask on right now. That's because they understood this. They knew that those face masks were essential. What happened in the United States is we don't have the face masks. Nobody planned ahead for this. And what they have realized, and they're, I think they ought to be a lot more transparent and honest about what happened, what they've realized is the masks that are in existence need to be reserved for healthcare workers. There's not enough for everybody to wear one. We're going to have to save them for healthcare workers. And that's the reason they're making up these bullshit stories about how supposedly the mask does more harm than good. The mask is a very, very effective containment measure when everyone in society wears one. And that's something that will not be possible in the United States because the people who your tax dollars pay to plan ahead and be ready for natural disasters like this didn't think about it ahead of time. So I really am concerned about what I'm calling now the great complacency. And what I mean by that is that as Americans, we pride ourselves in our liberty and our freedom. And folks, I'm not knocking that for one instant. I am the biggest believer in liberty and freedom. I think it's what makes the American Constitution a standout document that makes it better than the rest of the world. But in this particular instance, what we're doing is we're looking down our noses at these draconian measures that were used in China to contain their citizens, these lockdowns and almost martial law kind of behavior by the government. And we take great pride in saying that could never happen in the United States because we have our Constitution, we have our rights, we have our freedoms, we have our liberties. Okay, I think it's true that that kind of containment that you saw in China could not occur in the United States for those reasons. I agree with that. But I think people are missing the point. That's our greatest risk. What if it turns out that the only way to contain this virus is to get everybody to stay the heck home in their own home, not out spring breaking, not out spreading it, not going out to bars, not ignoring the guidance and advice that's been given, but everybody complying? We can't make everybody comply in the United States, and a lot of people are not going to comply. In fact, some of them are proudly on social media telling the world that they intend not to comply if it comes to that, and they're celebrating that as their right as Americans. This aspect of our culture is what makes us or has made us the greatest nation on earth in many ways, but just for this particular crisis, I don't think that it's going to help us. I think it could be our worst enemy. And it may be that we're unable to succeed the way China was at containing the Hubei province breakout, because we're not able to impose the kind of draconian measures on our society that they impose there. Now, as Winston Churchill famously said, Americans can always be counted on to do the right thing after first having exhausted all other possibilities. So I do think that we'll get to a national lockdown, but it'll probably come a month late and a million infections too late to show for it. We really need to put ourselves, I think, in the shoes of our healthcare workers and think about what is about to happen to them. This is just an epic story, and it breaks my heart. First of all, it's already asking an incredible amount of these heroes of our society to ask them to risk their own lives saving ours. Healthcare workers, to some extent, are prepared for that. They know that part of their job is being in harm's way in order to save lives. They signed up for that. But they signed up to do it in the United States of America, in a place where their needs as healthcare workers were generally treated very well. They expect to have the basic personal protective equipment, like face masks and gowns and so forth, that they need to protect themselves from infection. Because of these logistic screw-ups on the government's part, I've been reading stories about some regional hospitals actually issuing memos telling their doctors and nurses to recycle used face masks because there's just not enough to be ready for what's coming, and there's no source from which to order more, because most of them were all ordered from China, and nobody ever thought about this possibility. So we're not just asking our healthcare workers to face the most horrific challenge in recorded history, possibly, for healthcare, but we're asking them to do it at a time when we are unprepared to give them the most basic self-protection equipment that they need to do in order to do their jobs. And furthermore, many of them, and I've talked to Macro Voices listeners who are MDs, many of them have been pleading, begging their management for the last 6 weeks, saying, look, maybe the politicians don't get it, but we do. We didn't need to listen to Macro Voices. We understand epidemics and pandemic plagues. We know what's coming. We know we have to get our shit together. We need to order and get everybody ready with all the supplies we need. And they're not getting the support that they needed, because everybody, all the politicians who thought they knew better, insisted it could never happen here. Put yourself in the shoes of our doctors and nurses. How is it going to feel to them when they want to help people who are in dire need, and they go to put a face mask on and there's no face masks left? And their coworker next to them says, yeah, there's a pile of them over there. We got them out of the trash. We don't know who wore it last. And unfortunately, that's just the best we've got. Put yourself in that person's shoes. I could certainly understand people giving up and walking out under those circumstances. I hope for everyone's sake that that doesn't happen, but who the heck could blame them? So I think that what's coming in terms of the stress that it's going to put on our society, we already live in a very divided society where there's so much contention over, you know, whether you're pro-President Trump or anti-President Trump, whichever you are, you probably have a very strong view about that. Well, we're going to get to the point where the healthcare workers in our society are really being martyrs in many ways for a lot of mistakes that were made, in my opinion, by government. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox about that now, but it's obviously a subject I feel very passionately about. Let's move on now and be objective about what happened in Hubei province and why it can or cannot be as bad as that in the United States. Well, first things first, we've got a huge advantage over China, which is population density. The one natural thing that seems to affect this more than anything else is how many people are in close contact with other people. And the United States has more rural countryside and, you know, small towns and villages where you just don't have a lot of people. And if people at least are willing to follow the rules of social distancing and just stay home and not entertain guests and not get together in groups, in rural America, it's going to be fairly easy to fight this thing in ways that were simply not possible in China. The other advantage, sort of, is we got plenty of warning of this. Unfortunately, though, we squandered that warning. We mostly ignored it, and the government spent most of its time over the last 6 weeks reassuring everybody that nothing was wrong and there was nothing to worry about. We're not prepared for aggressive testing and so forth. Now, just to be clear, finally, a month late and a dollar short, the CDC has finally allowed private laboratories to do the testing. We're very quickly ramping up for testing, but it's not enough. It's still too late. And in terms of containment and contact tracing, what they did in Singapore, the reason they were able to contain things is as soon as they had any case identified, they wanted to know exactly where that person had been, who they'd spoken to, and so forth for the last month. They tracked down every single person that they had come in contact with. They quarantined them. They took it very seriously. We have people getting off of airplanes in the United States being tested positive for COVID-19. No attempt is made to contact the other passengers on the flight that were sitting next to them for the last 8 hours on their flight back from Italy. We're not doing anything close to the level of diligence around contact tracing and isolation, case isolation, and so forth that was done successfully in South Korea, in Taiwan, in Singapore, and in Hong Kong, which are the case studies for where this was done right and they were able to get things out of control. Now, frankly, it gets much worse than that. I'm sure many of you have seen the stories and photos about O'Hare Airport, but for anyone who hasn't, when you hear Vice President Pence saying confidently to the American people, we're screening all of the arriving passengers from Europe and we're completely on top of this situation. He really does have a good, confident voice about him. He's full of shit, okay? That's the reality of the situation. This screening doesn't mean that they're doing PCR tests or even thermometer tests, which wouldn't be effective really, but at least it would be a start. They're not doing any of that. They're asking people questions. Do you feel sick? A lot of people are being coached by their airlines on how to lie to get through the screening process. What they did when they told everybody to come back from Europe and said that they would be closing down travel to Europe, the whole point of this is supposedly we're trying to contain and prevent a massive COVID-19 outbreak. What did they do? They got thousands of passengers off of dozens of flights and packed them in like sardines, shoulder to shoulder, waiting for this screening process, which was apparently understaffed, for more than 8 hours in very, very close, shoulder to shoulder, closer than the spacing of people on the airplane environment, where you know that there's got to be somebody who's got it, otherwise they wouldn't be doing this. By the time you've waited 8 hours in that line, everybody's been exposed to it. It was not only ineffective, but it was profoundly counterproductive. The U.S. government's performance in terms of dealing with this crisis could not be worse. Look, I'm just as proud about being born in the United States as any of our listeners are. I'm not trying to be unpatriotic, but our job here is to look objectively at the facts. And the facts are that our government has not performed well in this crisis so far. Compare this with South Korea, where they very quickly instituted drive-through testing so that nobody would even have to go into the same building with another person, never mind be stuck for 8 hours shoulder to shoulder in a line at O'Hare Airport. Not only do we not wear masks, what we need is everyone wearing a mask. We can't have that because there aren't enough masks to go around. Instead of being honest and telling us what's really going on, the government is counterproductively telling us that these masks are actually doing harm, that it makes it worse if you wear a mask. What that means is if we eventually get an adequate supply of masks, if China is successful at getting their economy back online and can make a few hundred million masks and send them to us, the government will have preconditioned Americans to believe that they're no good and that they cause a problem. I think we need to really consider seriously that because of our Constitution and the liberties that we do cherish for good reason, we don't have the option of getting as draconian as China eventually did to contain this. We won't be able to do a complete hard lockdown of society the way China did. Some Americans will insist on expressing their freedom. They're already telling us on social media that they plan to do so. We do have the one advantage of population density, but frankly, that's the only advantage that I can see. So I, again, ask you, if you think that there's no way that what happened in Hubei province in China could ever happen in the United States, please ask yourself to justify that, not to me, but to yourself. What is your logical argument for why it's not possible for the U.S. to have an even worse experience than Hubei province had? As far as I can see, we're doing everything wrong from a policy standpoint. The one thing that we've got two things going for us. One is population density. We have more land and less people. The other is we had a lot of advance warning, but the vast majority of people, including the government, didn't take advantage of that advance warning. So we're totally unprepared for this. And if there's one lesson that I've learned from this entire experience to date, it is that in a situation like this, where it's very difficult for people to accept that something so unlike what we're used to is really and truly happening, people don't accept reality until after it happens. People don't accept reality until after it happens. It was clear on January 30th when I interviewed Dr. Chris Martinson that everything that's happening today was coming. It was really clear. Most of our own audience, which are really smart people, rejected it and said, that's crazy talk. That kind of thing can't happen here. Well, now it's starting to happen, but I think you can extend that and say, people are not going to come to terms with the scope of it until it actually happens. The fact that this is an exponential function, and that means that in the next 2 weeks, we're going to go from 100,000 cases to 1 million cases, and then the next month, we're going to go to 10 million cases. That is not going to register with people until it happens. So for that reason, my biggest conclusion right now is I think that June 1st is probably what it's going to take. You know, people have been asking me on Twitter, when's the market going to bottom? Is the bottom in yet? Is this the time to buy the bottom? I don't know what the number is on the S&P, but I think the timing of when do you buy the bottom, when would financial markets bottom? Probably not until June 1st, end of May, first week of June, in there somewhere. That's my best guess. And if you look at page 8 of Ferguson's report, you'll see why. My final topic for today, making it personal. Yeah, I think I've got this thing, folks. I'm sharing this for two reasons. One is I think a lot of people, you know, statistically, given the size of our audience, a lot of you are going to get this yourselves. Hopefully, you'll just have mild cases and we'll survive it. The experience of having it, even as someone who's studied it, it's quite different from what I expected. And I think that if I share some of my experience with you, it will help prepare you for what might be coming. Second reason, quite frankly, is because I know for a fact that engaging with my local healthcare, you know, go to the local doc in the box down the street, I know more about this crisis than they do. I've had several MDs who are listeners assure me of that. And we do have MDs who are listeners who are incredibly smart people. I figured out I'm on my own. I'm not going to get any help from medical facilities. What hospitals exist in my area will be overwhelmed with people who are incredibly contagious. There's no reason for me to want to go there unless I'm on the verge of dying. I don't expect to be. So far, I've got only mild symptoms. So I have to care for this by myself. And frankly, I'm going to tell you what my experience has been because I think it will help prepare some of you for what might be coming for you. But also because I know that some of the MDs in the audience will email me with their advice. And frankly, I need that advice because I can't go see a local MD. I don't want to take the infection risk of going to their office right now. So I woke up with a fever, dry, scratchy throat that felt like it wanted to turn into a cough and swollen glands on March 1st, Sunday. Had a 38 degree Celsius fever for Americans. What is that? I've forgotten what that translates to. It's, I think, 101 or so fever off the top of my head. 38.2 C is what I had. It only lasted 2.5 days. So my initial self-diagnosis was, okay, phew. The case studies that I saw in Martinson's videos all had people with a higher fever, typically 38.5 to 39, lasting for 7 or 8 days. I only had 2.5 days of fever. So I thought, whew, okay, this must be some other kind of bug. Guess it's not going to be COVID-19. What a relief. Since then, though, the dry, scratchy throat has persisted continuously. That's 2.5 weeks now, going on 3 weeks. This coming Sunday, it'll be 3 weeks. The good news is the fever seems to be mostly gone. I've been taking my temperature about 5 times a day because I'm paranoid. Occasionally, it's slightly elevated, half a degree C maybe, but usually it's, 36.9 is normal, and sometimes it's 37 or 37.1, but no big deal. So I don't have a high fever anymore. The scratchy throat that feels like a cough didn't really ever turn into a persistent cough. I cough maybe 2 or 3 times a day. I've coughed 3 or 4 times that our production editor has edited out that you didn't hear in the course of recording this interview. The symptoms that have only started in the last week or so, it's heaviness of the chest and a burning sensation in my lungs. I've been sick a lot before, but never experienced anything quite like this. It's like a warm, burning feeling right in the center of my chest. And it feels like I think heaviness of chest is the expression that they use. I'm not short of breath. Of course, I do feel like I don't want to try to exert myself, but I just sort of have this heaviness of chest, general kind of tired feeling, little dizzy, little spacey, not quite as plugged into just following my outline. My editors had to do more work on editing this interview. Edit, please. You hear me there just saying, edit, please? That's the way I ask them to fix it when I screw up. And I'm screwing up a lot in recording these podcasts, more than I usually do, because I'm not quite as, and what's the phrase I want? I can't even bring the phrase to mind. Mental something, or rather. I would know that word instantly if I were not feeling this. Mental acuity is the phrase I was looking for. It's not quite there. So the thing, though, that from everything I've read, these are not the symptoms of a severe COVID-19 case by any stretch, but they all seem to be completely consistent with a very mild case of COVID-19. So the good news is I don't think that I'm at risk of dying from this or anything like that. The thing that I didn't expect, though, and the reason I decided to just share all of this with you in a podcast is it's the emotion of being on your own. I know for a fact that it would be a mistake to try and go see a doctor. There'd be a bunch of people who really are contagious and definitely do have this thing in the waiting room. They haven't figured out how to manage the social distancing in the healthcare system yet. This is still new to them, and I know they can't give me the test. They're not allowed to. So I know there's no reason to do that. So I'm relying on WebMD and teaching myself. I've got some Tamiflu, I've got some chloroquinine that we got in case we got, to the point where, and we've got some Levaquin, whatever the stuff is that you're supposed to have for pneumonia if you need it, the antibiotic for pneumonia, we've got some of that. Interestingly, we went to a fair amount of work researching what medications, including prescription medications, would come into play in the treatment at home of this, if we had to do that. I had the foresight a month ago to think about that and went ahead and got a lot of those medications, including chloroquinine and Tamiflu, although I've only got one course of each of those. I've got a really terrific listener, Dr. Steve Bickle. If you're listening, thank you so much for sending me more chloroquinine. I hope it arrives here. And don't worry, don't rush it. I've got some to start with. But what I've realized is I never did the research of learning. What I should have learned is if you're going to have to treat yourself, you need to know the indications of when you would start taking these things. Should I start taking chloroquinine now because I think maybe I have this, or should I save it until I get to serious symptoms? I don't know. And fortunately, I have a podcast with a lot of smart MDs, so I'm pretty confident I'm going to find out from some of you, our listeners. Other listeners listening, though, you're not, unless you've got your own podcast, you're not going to learn that way. I will, as I learn more about this, maybe I'll do another podcast just sharing my self-diagnosis and treatment experience. But what I prepared for is, what if we get the life-threatening kind and we have to treat our own pneumonia in the house and everything? What are we going to do to be prepared for that? I never thought about the much more likely case is, I don't even know if I have it. I might have some other kind of respiratory infection that's just lasting for 3 weeks. I have no way of finding that out, so I'm not even sure whether this is COVID-19 or something else that I've got. And I have no idea, for a mild case, as I appear to have, whether any medications are even indicated or not. I should have done all that homework before I got to this point. Didn't think of that. These things become clear only afterwards. The hardest part about it, though, it's the emotion of having no idea. Do I have this? Do I not have it? I don't know. And I do know that it's impossible to find out because the testing is so screwed up that it's impossible for me to get a test. That's really frustrating. And it becomes preoccupying to know a fair amount about the opportunities government has had to get this right and how badly they've screwed it up. So those have been my symptoms for the last 18 days. The good news is it doesn't seem to be getting worse. The fever came back once or twice, like just a little bit, you know, 37 and a half kind of stuff. But it was only 2.5 days of actually feeling like I had the flu in the beginning. And for the last 2 weeks, it's just been this lingering thing with this burning sensation in the chest that won't go away. Doesn't seem like a big deal, but you wouldn't believe the difference between objectively learning about this because you're an investor and you're trying to figure out what it means to the economy, and you're reading about secondary infections and whether or not there's permanent lung damage is an aspect of this that hadn't really been studied at the beginning. When you're reading that stuff and you're learning about what it means to the economy, and all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, this is whether or not my personal lungs are ever going to recover from what this burning that I'm feeling in my chest, ever. It completely changes your experience of reading the research and learning about this. And it's difficult to maintain the same degree of objectivity because obviously it's very close to home all of a sudden. So, I just lost my train of thought right there. Normally when I record these podcasts, I'm pretty on it. And part of this experience, just to prepare you in case you get this, you're just not completely on top of your game. And boy, it sucks to have, you know, the best trading opportunities in the market of my entire investing career and not be all that sharp about staying on top of my trades because I'm a little scatterbrained from having this, whatever it is that I've got, probably COVID. I don't even know if I could say probably COVID-19. Might be. So as I said, I do have a really terrific guy who's a listener sending me some extra chloroquinine tablets. I'm going to have to start researching when I should start taking them and whether and when I should start taking the Tamiflu. It feels to me like I should save that until things start to feel serious. They don't feel serious yet, but this has gone on for coming up on 3 weeks. I wanted to share all of this, as I said, because I think statistically many of you are going to go through what I did, not a life-threatening case, but a mild case of this. And I'll tell you, the emotion of having no clue whether the lung damage is permanent or temporary, and knowing that the medical system is too busy right now researching how to deal with the pandemic. They don't have time to answer my questions about whether this is permanent lung damage that's occurring right now. You end up just having to wonder, really having no idea, reading what you can online, and being on your own. And it's a really different emotional experience than going in and getting medical care in a normal functioning system. And the thing is, we're still way early in the story. What we're headed toward is complete mayhem in the medical system where nobody can get any kind of answers from any doctor anywhere. So I feel lucky that if I am going through this, which I seem to be, at least it's happening to me sooner rather than later. I just see that we hit an hour on my timeline, so I'm going to wrap it up there. Before we go, I am going to pull rank here and insert my own sponsor message for this episode, since we don't have an outside sponsor. This episode of Macro Voices was sponsored by my own vacation rental on the coast of Maine. It's a 5-acre oceanfront family compound with 2 separate residences, 2 kitchens, and 8 king and queen bedrooms. In addition to that, there's a whole bunch of pull-out sofas and bunk beds and stuff, so we can actually sleep upwards of 30 people in a pinch, including all of the bunk beds. And it's super-duper popular. We were completely, totally sold out for this entire season. But my expectation is that the entire rental season is probably going to be a write-off. We have people planning to fly in from California and Seattle, and obviously that's now in serious question. I think we are or should be headed toward a national travel ban. You could not imagine a better safe haven to ride out the COVID-19 crisis than this property. It's extremely rural. You could not ask for better social distancing. has sunsets over the ocean, has a great big rec room with a pool table and a home theater and super fast 100 megabit cable internet to keep you connected to both Netflix and the financial markets and so forth. At this point, I think that the vacation rental season is going to be a write-off. So I'd like to find a tenant. Hopefully I can help somebody too. The ideal tenant would be, you know, a family in New York City who wants to get the hell out of the city to ride this crisis out in the countryside. Now, to be clear, the property is currently booked in July and August. I would need to renegotiate with my current reservations if I was going to rent it to someone else, but I've got a feeling that would be easy to do. So if you or anyone you know is looking to find a safe haven to spend the next few months out of New York City or whatever city you live in, I would suggest that unless you do it really soon, that you be close enough to drive to Midcoast, Maine. It's right on the oceanfront. It's got west-facing views, so you see the sunset over the ocean. It's a fantastic place to be. Normally, this is early season, but it's available starting right now. And I've got a feeling it's available all the way through the end of August. Now, it's totally booked, but I think it's going to get unbooked as this crisis unwinds. If anybody's interested in that, please contact me via info@macrovoices.com. Send me an email and I'll let you know more about it. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. Thanks for listening, everybody.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.